Darkcast Network. Out of the shadows comes the best of indie podcasts. Halloween is one of our favorite holidays. But did you know that in 1982, Halloween was almost canceled completely from American culture? While poisoned candy being given out to trick-or-treaters at Halloween is extremely rare, if existent at all, this particular incident, which unfolded in October 1982, raised renewed fears. Some communities discouraged trick-or-treating altogether for Halloween, and American grocery stores reported that candy sales were down more than 20%. This event single-handedly almost ended Halloween in the United States. Halloween being my favorite holiday, that story truly terrifies me. My name is DJ, and this is the Mythical True Crime Podcast. Hello, and welcome to tonight's show. With the Halloween season quickly approaching, I felt this story was highly appropriate for this time of year. Not only is the weather getting cooler, the nights are getting longer, but we're starting to see all the festive Halloween decorations start showing up at our local stores. What's your favorite thing about this time of year? Leave me a comment. You can find me on every social media platform, including Threads. The Darkcast Network and I are collaborating for a spooky Halloween event coming up, so stay tuned for that. Now, as I was mentioning at the top of the show, this event almost single-handedly ended Halloween in the United States. And it's the reason we have tamper-evident safety seals on bottles on every store shelf. On September 28, 1982, 12-year-old girl named Mary Kellerman was hospitalized after consuming a capsule of extra-strength Tylenol. She died the next day. On the 29th, six other individuals consuming contaminated Tylenol, including Adam Janis, Stanley Janis, Teresa Janis, all of which who took the Tylenol from a single bottle. All six, the Janises, Mary McFarland, Paula Prince, and Mary Reiner, would ultimately lose their lives from the consumption. Asked to investigate into the Janises' death, nurse Helen Jensen, Arlington Heights' only public health official, visited the Janises' household and discovered a Tylenol bottle with an accompanying receipt indicating that it had been purchased that same day. Noticing that there were six pills missing, she turned the bottle over to investigator Nick Pishos, who reported her suspicion as it was related to the Janises' deaths. Pishos called Dr. Edmund Donahue, deputy chief medical examiner for Cook County, who suspected that cyanide might be the culprit, asked Pishos to smell the bottle. When Pishos smelled the almond-like scent, Donahue asked the county's chief toxicologist, Michael Schaefer, to test the capsules, and Schaefer's team determined that each of the remaining 44 capsules inside the Janises' bottle contained nearly three times the fatal amount of cyanide. Authorities held a press conference advising the public not to take Tylenol for the time being. By chance, the bottle of Tylenol that Kellerman used was inventoried by paramedics. Investigators noticed that the Janis bottle and the Kellerman bottle came from the same lot, MC2880, and Johnson & Johnson issued a recall for all Tylenol from that lot. But when the tainted bottles from other lots were discovered, for example, the pills that Mary McFarland's possession traced were from lots 1910MD and MB23738, The recall expanded to cover those lots and any bottles of any extra-strength capsules from any lot purchased within the Chicago area, making this one of the largest pharmaceutical recalls ever. A multi-agency investigation found the tampered pills to have been sold on and put back on the shelves at a variety of stores in the Chicago area, including two different Jewel Foods, one on Arlington Heights and one in Elk Grove Village, and an Osco drugstore, a Walgreens, and a Dominick's, all within Chicago, as well as a Frank's Finer Foods in Wineville. One bottle that had been purchased, but due to an off-scent, not used by Linda Morgan, wife of Judge Lewis V. Morgan. In an effort to reassure the public, Johnson & Johnson, the manufacturer of Tylenol, distributed warnings to hospitals and distributors and halted Tylenol production and advertising. After other incidents, like strychnine adding to Tylenol bottles in California, a nationwide recall of Tylenol products was issued on October 5, 1982, with an estimated 31 million bottles in circulation, with the retail value of over $100 million. The company also advertised in a national media for individuals not to consume any of its products that contained acetaminophen after it was determined that only these capsules had been tampered with. Johnson & Johnson also offered to exchange all Tylenol capsules already purchased by the public for solid tablets. Customs at airports outside the U.S. were even asking visitors if they brought Tylenol medicine with them. Now, the tainted capsules were found to have been manufactured at two different locations, Pennsylvania and Texas, suggesting that the capsules were tampered with after the product was placed on the store shelves. The police previously hypothesized that someone had taken the bottles off the shelf in a local store in Chicago, placed potassium cyanide in some of the capsules, and then placed the package back on the store shelves to be purchased by unknowing customers. In addition to the five bottles that led to these victims' deaths, a few other contaminated bottles were later discovered in the Chicago area. In early 1983, at an FBI's request, the Chicago Tribune columnist Bob Green published the address and grave location to the first and youngest victim, Mary Kellerman. The story, written with the Kellerman's family's consent, was proposed by the FBI criminal analyst John Douglas on the theory that the perpetrator might visit the house or gravesite if he was made aware of the locations. Both sites were kept under 24-hour video surveillance for several months, but no killer surfaced. A surveillance photo of Paula Prince purchasing cyanide-tampered Tylenol at the Walgreens at the 1601 North Wells Street in Chicago was released by the Chicago Police Department. Police believed that a bearded man, seen just feet behind Prince, may have been the killer. Now, before we get into the suspects, I, like you, have heard this story, but I've heard type of urban legends stories about Tylenol being bad for you. Acetaminophen, from my understanding, metabolizes in your liver, much like alcohol, which is why you do not want to mix them. You shouldn't mix any drugs with alcohol, so there's your PSA, kids. But I remember vaguely hearing this story that Tylenol was being laced and you shouldn't have Tylenol at all. Could have been a PR stunt by a rival pain reliever company? Or was it random people doing one of the sickest things and wanting to harm others, innocent people? During the initial investigations, a man named James William Lewis was accused of sending a letter to Johnson & Johnson demanding $1 million to stop the cyanide-induced murders. Upon his arrest, Lewis told authorities how the person behind the attacks may have carried out the killings by buying Tylenol, adding cyanide to the bottles, and returning them to the store shelves. Lewis was also had been found previously possessing a poisoning book, and according to confidential law enforcement documents, his fingerprints were discovered on the pages related to cyanide. Lewis denied being responsible for the poisonings, but he did admit to writing the letter, which he said he had worked on for 3 days. During the trial, his attorneys claimed that Lewis intended only to focus the attention of the authorities on his wife's former employer. Lewis was convicted of extortion and sentenced to 10 years in prison. In 2007, authorities determined that the letter had an October 1st, 1982 postmark, meaning that if Lewis's 3-day timeline was accurate, he would have begun working on the letter prior to the first news reports concerning the poisonings. When confronted with this information, Lewis recanted his timeline. Court documents then released later in early 2009 showing the Department of Justice investigators concluding that Lewis was responsible for the poisonings, despite the fact that he did not have enough evidence to charge. In January 2010, both Lewis and his wife submitted DNA samples and fingerprints to the authorities. Lewis said, "If the FBI plays fair, I have nothing to worry about." The DNA samples did not match any DNA recovered on the bottles. Lewis continued to deny responsibility for the poisonings. Lewis died July 9, 2023, at the age of 76. Police also investigated a second man, Roger Arnold, a dock worker at the Jewel Osco in Melrose Park, who told officers that he had possessed potassium cyanide. Bar owner Marty Sinclair, whose establishment Arnold frequented, reported Arnold to the police, saying that Arnold had discussed killing people with a white powder and had been increasingly erratic after his marriage had dissolved. Arnold had worked with Reiner's father at a warehouse, and Arnold's wife had also been treated at a hospital across the street from the store from which Reiner bought the cyanide-laced pills. A copy of The Poor Man's James Bond, which contained instructions on making potassium cyanide, was found in Arnold's home. Arnold was held several times by the police, but never officially charged. And in the summer of 1983, Arnold, mistaking John Stencia for Sinclair, shot and killed Stencia, a computer consultant and father of three, who was leaving a bar with multiple friends. Arnold was convicted of the killing January 1984 and served 15 years of his 30-year sentence for second-degree murder, saying in 1996 from prison, quote, "I killed a man, a perfectly innocent person. I had choices. I could have walked away." He died June 2008, and in 2010, Arnold's body was exhumed and subsequently reburied so that his femur bone could be removed for DNA testing. Arnold's DNA also did not match the DNA samples discovered on the bottles. After this quick message, we'll be right back. If this is your first time tuning in, I encourage you to subscribe to the show so you can hear all the other episodes, as well as what we have coming up in the next few weeks. In early January 2009, Illinois authorities renewed the investigation. Federal agents searched the home of Lewis in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and seized a number of items. And in Chicago, an FBI spokesperson declined comment, but said, "We'll have something to release, possibly later." In 2010, DNA samples were collected again from Lewis and Arnold. Arnold previously, as we mentioned, was exhumed, but nobody's DNA evidence matched the samples of the tainted bottles. Law enforcement officials received numerous tips related to the case, coinciding with its 25th anniversary. In a written statement, the FBI explained, quote, This review was prompted, in part, by the recent 25th anniversary of this crime and the resulting publicity. Further, given that many recent advances in forensic technology, it's only natural that a second look be taken at the case and recovered evidence. On May 19, 2011, the FBI requested DNA samples from Unabomber Ted Kaczynski in related to the Tylenol murders. However, Kaczynski denied ever having possession of potassium cyanide, and the first four Unabomber crimes happened in Chicago and its suburb in 1978 to 1980, and Kaczynski's parents had a suburban home in Chicago in Lombard, Illinois, in 1982, where he occasionally stayed. Hundreds of copycat attacks involving Tylenol, including other over-the-counter medications and other products that took place in the United States, immediately followed the Chicago deaths. Three more deaths occurred in 1986 from tampered gelatin capsules. 23-year-old Diana Ellsworth died in Yonkers, New York, after ingesting extra-strength Tylenol laced with cyanide. Excedrin tablets in Washington State were tampered with, resulting in the deaths of Susan Snow and Bruce Nickel from cyanide poisoning and the eventual arrest and conviction of Bruce Nickel's wife, Stella Nickel, for the intentional actions of the crimes connected to both of the murders. Now, that same year, Procter & Gamble's product, Incaprin, was recalled after having a spike hoax in Chicago and Detroit that resulted in the sales drop and withdrawal of the pain reliever from the market. In 1991, in Washington State, Kathleen Daneker and Stanley McHorter were both killed by two cyanide-taped boxes of Sudafed, and Jennifer Mailing also went into a coma with a similar poisoning, but recovered shortly thereafter. Jennifer's husband, Joseph, was convicted on numerous charges in the federal Seattle court regarding the deaths of Daneker and McHorter and the attempted murder of his wife, who was abused during Mailing's marriage. Mailing was sentenced to imprisonment and lost an appeal for a retrial. He was sentenced to life. In 1986, University of Texas student Kenneth Ferries was found dead in his apartment after succumbing to cyanide poisoning. Tampered anacin capsules were determined to be the source of the cyanide found inside of his body. His death was ruled a homicide May 30, 1986. And June 19th, the Associated Press reported that Travis Medical Examiner ruled his death likely a suicide, and the FDA determined he obtained the poison from a lab from which he worked. Now, Johnson & Johnson received positive coverage for its handling of the crisis. For example, an article the Washington Post wrote, "Johnson & Johnson has effectively demonstrated how a major business ought to handle a disaster." The article further stated that this is no Three Mile Island incident, in which the company's response did more damage than the original incident, and applauded the company for being honest with the public. In addition to issuing the recall, the company established relations with the Chicago Police Department, the FBI, and the FDA. This way, it could also be part of the search for the person who laced the capsules, and they could help prevent further tampering. While at the time of the scare, the company's market share collapsed from 35% to 8%, it rebounded in less than a year, a move credited to the company's prompt and aggressive reaction. In November, it reintroduced the capsules in a new triple-sealed package, coupled with a heavy price promotion. With several years, Tylenol regained the highest market share of the over-the-counter pain reliever in the United States. After the recall, Johnson & Johnson's subsidiary, McNeil Laboratories, submitted a claim to its insurance company for the cost of carrying out the recall, a claim which was later denied. A lawsuit determined that McNeil Laboratories was ultimately not covered because the parent company, Johnson & Johnson, elected not to buy more expensive recall insurance. McNeil sued again in court, further contending that the language of the company Johnson & Johnson had in its excess liability insurance policy covered the recall and recall related expenses. Now, the court hearing the case rejected the claim of liability, stating that the recall was not caused by liability for the seven deaths. It was at best merely related to the seven deaths in which they served as notice to the plaintiff that the Tylenol remaining on the shelves was potentially harmful. In 1991, Johnson & Johnson agreed to settle for an undisclosed sum all lawsuits against it for the original Chicago area deaths. Robert Niffen, a spokesperson for the Johnson & Johnson company, stated that though there was no way that we could have anticipated a criminal tampering with the product or even prevented it, we wanted to do something for the families and get this tragic event behind us. The crisis management response, taught today as a model of corporate public relations, is chiefly credited to public relations executive Harold Burson. Now, the 1982 incident inspired the pharmaceutical, food, and consumer product industries to develop tamper-resistant packaging that we know and love today, such as the induction seals and the improved quality control methods. Moreover, product tampering was also made a federal crime. New laws resulted in Stella Nichols' conviction in the Excedrin tampering case, for which she was sentenced to 90 years in prison. Additionally, the incident prompted the pharmaceutical industry to move away from capsules altogether, which were easy to contaminate as a foreign substance could be introduced and placed inside without any obvious signs of tampering. Within a year, the FDA introduced a more stringent regulation to avoid product tampering. This led to the eventual replacement of the capsule with the solid caplet, a tablet that was in the shape of the capsule as the drug delivery form, and with the addition of tamper-evident safety bottles on all sorts. Now, as I mentioned at the top of the episode, while this was going on, the Halloween season was also going on, and you know, people were still worrying about poison candy. If you'd like to hear more about poison candy, I have an episode called The Real Candyman, Ronald O'Brien. That episode and many more are available in the Mythical True Crime Podcast Library, anywhere you can listen to your podcasts. That concludes tonight's episode. Not much paranormal going on in this, however, it does deal with how fast stories transfer through folklore and urban legends. If you'd like to hear more urban legends, you could contact me on any social media platform, or let me know of any other kind of show you want to listen to. The Darkcast Network and I are always open to suggestions for the topics of future shows. You can find me and the Darkcast Network on Facebook, Twitter, which is X now, I believe, Instagram, and also Threads. And if you like this show, please consider subscribing. Subscribing through Buzzsprout helps me monetarily to keep this show going. Not only would you be supporting an indie podcaster, you'd be getting more episodes like the one tonight. This has been the Mythical True Crime Podcast. Good night. Thank you very much for listening tonight and being part of the Mythical True Crime community, hosted by me, DJ. Subscribe to Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to get your weekly updates. And if you like what you hear, consider subscribing. Subscribing will directly support the show and the work that I'm doing. If you'd like to be a new supporter, consider clicking the link in the description box below. For less than a cup of coffee a month, you can help me continue to make great content for listeners everywhere. No commitment, cancel anytime. This has been the Mythical True Crime Podcast. My name is DJ. Good night.